Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, February 7th. Don't look now, but a little bit of bipartisanship and strange bedfellowship seems to be breaking out in Washington. And contrary to most major news headlines, some wins for President Biden as the midterm election year gets underway. This bipartisanship, strange bedfellowship includes the crisis in Ukraine, the attack on the ISIS leader in Syria, a major economic bill in Congress, just as the president can crow about the January jobs numbers, Omicron on the run, and even a little bit on January 6th and the big lie. Did you hear Mike Pence on Friday?
I heard this week that President Trump said I had the right to overturn the election. But President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. The presidency belongs to the American people and the American people alone. And frankly, there is no idea more un-American than the notion that any one person could choose the American president. Under the Constitution, I had no right to change the outcome of our election. And Kamala Harris will have no right to overturn the election when we beat them in 2024.
So that was Pence speaking to the conservative lawyers group, the Federalist Society, last week. Maybe he's just running for president and has no choice if he's going to be a competitor to Trump, but it's certainly a change. So we will start there and go on to the war footing around the globe, vaccine victories over the virus, and new wins on the economy with Grace Seeger, staff writer for The New Republic, who is writing about most of these things. Grace, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So what's up with Mike Pence?
Well, I think that Pence, having been there on January 6th, having had his life endangered with the rioters literally chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," he recognizes the gravity of the situation in a way that perhaps many other Republicans do not. For him, it is indeed personal. And he made the personal decision on that day to continue with his constitutional duty. We haven't seen him challenge Trump this much over January 6th, although he had previously said that the two do not see eye to eye on it. But this is really the first time that he's kind of staking out his ground on it. And I think considering what he personally went through and how he views his constitutional duty, and indeed the specter of 2024, all of that kind of factors into why he said these things.
And in that talk, Pence said, quote, "There's more at stake than our party or political fortunes. If we lose faith in the Constitution, we won't just lose the election, we'll lose our country." And that is really further than he's gone before. So do you think they'll kick him out of the party now like they're doing with Liz Cheney?
Well, I don't know if I would go that far. He is definitely staking out his ground as the leader of another wing of the party, perhaps saying that he stands with Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, although hopefully not as politically toxic as them if he wants to run in 2024.
Your latest January 6th recap article is about emerging evidence on how far Trump was willing to go to overturn the election. And one of your references was to papers from the National Archives that might show who was lobbying Pence to not certify the electors. What are you looking for there?
Well, you have a bunch of people on the Trump side of the equation, Trump's allies, who were hoping to figure out a way to get Mike Pence to unilaterally overturn the election. Trump's lawyers were very into this theory, trying to figure out a way that they could use the Electoral Count Act, which sort of determines the guidelines for how electoral college votes are certified. They're trying to figure a way to get around that, trying to make it seem constitutional that one person had the opportunity to overturn a duly elected president-elect. And it seems as if Pence really did have a lot of personal choice here, where there's a scenario where he could have followed along with this cockamamie plan and decided not to. But there was a lot of constitutionally questionable legalizing going on here. And we're beginning to see that emerge from the January 6th committee.
Yeah. A lot of the rest of the article that you wrote about outrageous things Trump considered but actually didn't do, like using the National Security Agency to try to gin up something before January 6th about foreign interference on behalf of Biden in the campaign, and getting the Justice Department to pressure Georgia to reject its own electors and some other things. But they never actually did these things, though we know about the Trump phone call to Georgia's Secretary of State, but some of the other ways, despite the evidence they were considered. So how much trouble can they get Trump in as he mulls a run for 2024? Because the subhead of your article says a lot of things are adding up to Trump might be in a heap of trouble.
Really depends on who is conducting the trouble for Trump. So we're not really sure yet what the January 6th committee itself can do. They right now are gathering evidence, looking at these documents. Eventually, they might try to call Trump or even his family members. I'm sure that will be mired in lawsuits the second that they attempt to subpoena the former president. But there's also the possibility that the Justice Department could take action here. This could get a little bit dicey because a Justice Department prosecuting a former president is extremely unprecedented. This has never been done before. So we're not really sure how exactly this could go down. But there's possibility that the Justice Department could take action. There are investigations into the president from local district attorneys, including in Georgia, that may come to fruition. So there are local and state possibilities for prosecution as well. But the thing to really keep in mind is that we are in completely uncharted territory here, with having a former president not only actively seek to overturn the election, but also now be investigated for it and perhaps even face a penalty.
And one more ounce of what might be called bipartisan sanity here before we move on to other issues like Ukraine and the economic winds. You report that Senator Lindsey Graham says he would not support Trump pardoning January 6th rioters who were convicted of crimes, as Trump said he might do if he's elected president again. Lindsey Graham has been so, decisively on both sides of these issues. So what's his story at this point, as far as you could tell?
Lindsey Graham is a staunch ally of Trump in the Senate. The two are relatively close. They play golf together. And I would not go so far as to say that this is a sign that Graham is turning his back on President Trump. That is, I think, far from the truth. But what we are seeing is that Graham is willing to stake out certain positions and draw a line in the sand. And for him, it actually is consistent to say that he is against violence against the police, which there very much was on January 6th at the Capitol with the attacks on Capitol and Metropolitan Police. So it is consistent for him to say that, you know, a riot on the Capitol is bad, and he doesn't think that the people who were involved should be pardoned. What's interesting about it is that it's just so divergent from the position that Trump has, and indeed Trump called Lindsey Graham a rhino for saying it, but Graham didn't back down after that quote from Trump, and I would expect that this is a position that he will continue to stake out.
You're a rhino, wink, wink, meet you at the first tee. All right, let's go on to bipartisanship on Ukraine. Your article on that cites a joint appearance on CNN's State of the Union last week, by the Democratic chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Menendez, and the ranking Republican, Jim Risch. Here's a minute of them piling on Russia together. Risch speaks first.
Russia is simply a gas station that is masquerading, thinly disguised masquerading as a country. This is going to have a devastating effect on the economy around the world when it comes to the price of gasoline. If you're someone who doesn't care about the price of gasoline or oil, that's fine. But if you do have a concern about the quality of life for people all over the world, this is something always you have to consider, and you always have to take these things into consideration, particularly when you're sympathy in trying to help democratic countries.
And as I wrap this,
a brief comment on that. Listen, this is beyond Ukraine, although certainly we dramatically support Ukraine. We cannot have a Munich moment again. Putin will not stop with Ukraine if he believes that the West will not respond.
Democrat Menendez and Republican Risch with CNN's Dana Bash. Risch and Menendez are the top senators in their parties on the Foreign Relations Committee. Grace Seegers from the New Republic is our guest. Why'd you write about that CNN appearance?
Well, it is always intriguing to see a bipartisan appearance, members of opposite parties on a major news channel together as a show of strength. I think that one of the goals that Congress has with considering a sanctions package against Russia is to show Russia that whatever they do, the United States as a whole will have some kind of response. They want to show that any sanctions package has strong bipartisan backing. And I think that this is an attempt for a show of unity among members of Congress to sort of say to Russia, we're not backing down and we will respond in full. They're not going to be sort of wishy-washy about their response where it's just going to be one party but not going to have the backing of the full Congress. This is sort of a way for Menendez and Risch and largely most Republicans and Democrats in Congress to say that there will be consequences and we will impose them together.
If Mitch McConnell's guiding star is to make Joe Biden look bad on everything, why are Republicans in the Senate supporting him on Ukraine?
Well, we know traditionally that Republicans are hawks, and it is kind of easy to forget because so much has changed. But there is still that position that holds sway among the majority of the party, and you see the libertarian streak that's against getting involved in foreign conflicts. But most Republicans do want to act very forcefully against Russia. And again, that might seem counterintuitive after 4 years of Donald Trump, but this is traditionally the position that they have staked out. And I think that it is one that holds for the majority of the party, especially in the Senate, maybe less so in the House, but they do want to see Russia be punished. And in fact, they don't think that Biden is showing enough strength and being forceful enough in countering Putin.
Before we go to the winds on the economy and some phone calls, and looks like we're getting some interesting calls on the January 6th investigations in particular, and also, listeners, our second segment today, when we're done with Grace Seegers from the New Republic, we're going to look at why this is the month that legal weed sales are supposed to begin in New Jersey, but it's not going to happen. We're going to dig into that with Caroline Lewis from Gothamist, who's done a very deeply reported article on all the obstacles to launching the cannabis dispensaries in New Jersey right now. So we'll do that coming up later this hour. But, you know, there's a kind of complementary and opposite angle on Ukraine politics, Grace, in Mother Jones now about dissenters from going hard against Russia on Ukraine. It cites peace camp progressives who are skeptical of the U.S. deploying more troops to Eastern Europe, uncomfortably aligned with hard right Putin-friendly, Trump-friendly conservatives like Tucker Carlson. Here he is briefly on Fox.
Who's got the energy reserves? Who's the major player in world affairs? Who's the potential counterbalance against China, which is the actual threat? Why would we take Ukraine's side? Why wouldn't we have Russia's side? I'm totally confused.
Some counterbalance against China, as they had a nice huggy meeting in Beijing as the Olympics were getting underway. But is there some kind of progressive caucus, U.S. hands off the world, meets Putin, pro-Trump, authoritarianism-friendly coalition here on foreign policy?
Those would be strange bedfellows indeed, and I don't think that you would ever see a progressive member of Congress say that they were aligning with Tucker Carlson on any subject. But there is some grain of agreement here where there are a lot of progressives, and particularly younger progressives, who are particularly scarred by interference in foreign conflicts. So for younger progressives, having grown up with the shadows of the failed wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, they don't want to see the U.S. become mired in another conflict, and they are just naturally skeptical of that. We haven't seen as many progressive members of Congress actively talk about being against sanctions on Russia or some kind of interference in Ukraine, but there's definitely that skepticism there that is shared with Tucker Carlson and his ilk, although the origins may be a little bit different and they disagree on everything else. There is that sense of, well, why do we want to get involved in another foreign conflict? Let's just stay in our lane, as it were. And I think that there is a little bit of overlap there.
Is the common thread in these stories that we've talked about so far that for all the media focus on divisions within the Democratic Party, it's mostly just Joe Manchin when we're talking about the economy. There are some other things like how far to go on bail reform. But the Republicans are deeply divided on things like Russia and January 6th, and it doesn't get that much ink. Is that a fair takeaway?
I think part of the problem here, if you are a Democrat wondering, hey, why is our disarray covered so much in the media compared to Republicans? I mean, Democrats are in the majority. They have control of the House, Senate, and White House. And yes, that majority is tenuous, but they are in the majority. And if they don't accomplish things, ultimately that is on them for not being able to get every single member in line. Now, if in 2022 Republicans take back the House and or the Senate, perhaps both, then I would expect to see the same level of scrutiny of them as we saw in 2017 when they had the majority in House and White House and weren't necessarily able to get their act together on certain things, such as an Obamacare repeal, not being able to enact that. But I mean, that's part of the pitfalls of being in the majority, is that you are going to get extra scrutiny. And if you are unable to enact your biggest legislative priorities, even if it's only one or two members standing in the way, that is still worth reporting on and remarking upon.
We've covered outbursts of bipartisanship and strange bedfellowship on foreign policy and January 6th. Biden got a nice win on Friday with the January jobs numbers so much better than expected. Here he is on that.
This morning's report caps off my first year as president. And over that period, our economy created 6.6 million jobs. 6.6 million jobs. You can't remember another year when so many people went to work in this country. There's a reason. It never happened.
It never happened, says Joe Biden on Friday. And you wrote an article that day, Grace, citing those numbers, and also that Congress is poised to hand Biden a big economic win. On what kind of bill is that?
So this is a bill on competitiveness aimed at increasing competitiveness with China, easing some supply chain woes. It is focused on sort of boosting creation of semiconductor chips, which go into all sorts of things, especially cars. And so creating more of those could help ease the backlog and increase car production. And there are also provisions of the bill aimed at boosting trade and sort of reasserting the US's position as a major global economic power to counter the emergence of China. So the idea is to bring the US fully into the 21st century and reassert its power. And there is a fair amount of bipartisan support for different versions of this bill. The version of the bill that passed in the House on Friday only passed with one Republican vote, and the rest was all Democrats. There was a Senate version of the bill that passed last year that was far more bipartisan. So now what Congress has to do is get together and reconcile these two bills until they come up with a compromise that is agreeable to all, and then they can send that to President Biden's desk. He can sign it and say, look at how we are boosting competitive with China and creating semiconductor chips and addressing our supply chain problems. So it's still far from the end point, but this was another step in bringing some economic good news to Biden.
So do they have 10 Republicans so that this bill won't be killed by a filibuster?
That is exactly the problem. Now, the bill, the version of the bill that passed last year in the Senate, that did have the support from almost 20 Republicans. So more than enough to be approved in the Senate. The version that just passed in the House, probably not. Like I said, it only got one Republican vote in the House. And there are a lot of issues with it that Republicans are kind of iffy about. They don't like the amount of spending on climate-related provisions, for example. Some say that it is too soft on China because it eases immigration restrictions for certain entrepreneurs and high-level workers. So that's why the House and the Senate have to get together now for a process known as conferencing, and they are going to work together to find the middle ground on these two bills. There are a lot of overlap, and create a bill that is amenable to all.
Grace Seeger is covering all these things for the New Republic. Thanks for your deeply reported pieces, Grace. We really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.